Well, good morning again, and welcome, and happy 2012. I guess I now know who the partiers are at St. Paul's Church, and they're not you, apparently. So just glad you could drag yourself up out of bed on this January 1st. And it's just, this weather is kind of freaking me out. It's kind of nice in a way, you know, but when it's 50 degrees, you know, at 11 o'clock on New Year's Eve, you just don't know quite what to do with yourself. Well, I got to say, I really knew yesterday that the new year was upon us when I went outside to my doorstep and picked up my Sunday Times. And as I always do, well, first I look at the car section because I'm just really into cars. You know, I was talking with a guy in our church once, and he also subscribes to the Sunday Times. And he said, you know, I love the Sunday Times, but I got to say, who on earth reads the car section? Like, who actually reads that part? I was like, I do. So thank you for your implied judgment. But in any event, I flipped through and found the New York Times Magazine, which after I look at the car section, that's the second thing I look at. And what happened to be on the cover of this week's issue, but this wonderful tagline, do you have to be superhuman to lose weight? Do you have to be superhuman to lose weight? And then I was watching Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve last night. And there was a Weight Watchers commercial featuring Jennifer Hudson, who, if you remember, was of American Idol fame. And now I think she's in Chicago, actually. She's become a huge pop star. And it showed a picture of herself singing back when she was an American Idol and shows her now when she's clearly lost, like, you know, 30 or 40 pounds. And then this morning I watched about 5 minutes of SportsCenter because I saw that my UConn Huskies had won and I wanted to watch some of the highlights. And who should I see doing another Weight Watchers commercial but Charles Barkley, who's the former Philadelphia 76ers forward. You know, he came and said, no, I'm still not a role model. If you remember that 20 years ago, he was saying, I'm not a role model. I don't want to be a role model because he was always very foul-mouthed. But that makes him an incredibly wonderful NBA commentator. But in any event, so between this and Jennifer Hudson and Charles Barkley, you can tell that the New Year's on the way because, of course, this is the time of year when people are making New Year's resolutions. And I remember last January there was this little bit on one of the little tech blogs I read called Gizmodo that showed a graph of Google searches for, you know, health clubs and weight management programs that in January were just like, and then, you know, February, and then the whole rest of the year, December, and then January, and then the whole rest of the year. And then, so this is the time of the year when people are thinking about their lives. They're thinking about themselves, and specifically they're thinking about how they want to better themselves, what they want to do in this new year to kind of feel better about themselves, to help themselves out. And, you know, weight may not be your thing in particular. It may be, but it may not be. But my guess is that there is something about yourself that you would really like to change if you could. You know, there's some persistent struggle that you have, which if it suddenly disappeared, your life, you feel like, would be a lot easier. Maybe you struggle with anger. Maybe you find yourself being sort of constantly angry, or maybe you don't quite have the work ethic that you wish you did, or maybe you wish that you were a little bit more self-controlled, or maybe you wish you were a little bit less self-controlled, that you could let yourself off the hook a little bit more easily. Or maybe you have a tough time loving other people or conveying love to other people in a way that they can receive and understand. You have a tough time forgiving or dealing with your anxiety or your depression or whatever it might be. You know, maybe you just wish, because sometimes I wish this, I think sometimes we all wish this, maybe you just wish that you were a different person altogether. You feel like that your life would be easier if you were just a different person. And of course, some of these motivations are good. You know, if you live with someone else, if you're married or you have a roommate or family you live with or children, then you probably recognize that there are some things about your personality that have a negative impact on the people around you, and you wish you could just kind of take a little scalpel and excise that part from your personality. But my guess is that your motivation is probably primarily selfish and self-centered in that, you know, you believe that you would be more successful and happier and sort of better able to sleep at night and better able to accept yourself if you could just get some aspect of your life under control, and really only you know what that is. But the thing is, and you know, the author of this particular article, Tara Parker Pope, talks about it really beautifully and poignantly in the context of weight loss specifically. It's really, really hard to change yourself. You know, even Ms. Parker Pope, who ironically is the health and wellness editor for the New York Times, admitted that she's currently about 60 pounds overweight, and that she's been on diets and regained it and lost it and regained it. And she just talks very poignantly about it and looking back into her own past and recognizing that she always had a mother who's either on a diet or cheating on her diet. You know, that she comes by this very honestly, that she in many ways is just, you know, repeating the sins of the father, as they say, and that, you know, we all probably struggle with the same things that our parents struggled with. But, you know, as she said, she's like, no one likes being fat. And she finds it embarrassing. You know, she tells this very difficult story where I guess she was at some sort of party with a some sort of publishing party with her boyfriend, and some woman comes up and shakes her hand and goes, "You're Tara Parker Pope? Well, you're much different than I expected." You know, knowing that she's like a health author, and her Tara's boyfriend immediately says, "Oh, you mean you thought she'd be thinner?" And this woman goes, "No, I thought you'd be older." You know, because she's I guess in her late 20s, early 30s. But in any event, it's very difficult to change, and even as Tara sort of looks far and wide for people who have succeeded in the long term at keeping the weight off, she looks at their lives and just the day in, day out struggle that it is. As one of them says, you know, "I don't always think about food, but it's never far from my mind." You know, that in order to stay thin, they have to be sort of obsessed with counting calories, obsessed with weighing themselves. You know, before they go out to dinner or to eat at a restaurant, they look up the menu online and calculate the calories so that they'll know exactly what they can and can't eat when they get there. And she sees these people, and she looks at her own life, and she just sort of says, "I'm not sure I could do that. You know, I guess I could exercise 2 hours a day, but it would cause the rest of my life to suffer greatly, and maybe it's just not worth it to be so obsessed with food. You know, maybe the cure for my weight problem is worse than the sickness itself." And the truth is that for the vast majority of people, the battle they have with their weight is not one that they're going to win. You know, over 90% of people who take off 10 or 20 or 30 or 60 or 100 pounds within a matter of years have gained it all back and are right back where they started. And it seems to be the case that recidivism and not victory is the rule. Recidivism and not victory. And of course, this is true not just of weight gain and loss. It's true really in every area of our lives. As I said before, there are things that we do, and not just things that we do, but things that we are, of which we are ashamed, that we wish we could change, that we just don't want to look at. And every so often we sort of, you know, gird our loins and gather up all our strength and we say, "I'm going to change this thing about myself. I'm going to get under control. I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to, you know, as Dez says in Last Days of Disco, I'm going to turn over a new leaf. I'm going to turn over a whole bunch of new leaves." And maybe we even succeed for a little while. We have some victory. We have some breakthrough. But then I think most often, unless you're an incredibly diligent, self-controlled, willpower all the way type person, we begin to slide back into old habits of behavior and old ways of being. And we find ourselves right back where we were before. And it seems that, you know, as hard as we work and hard as we run, we seem to not be able to outrun ourselves. And in the end, we often wonder whether the effort was really worth it to begin with. Because, you know, maybe we got our lust under control a little bit. And suddenly we become really angry. You know, like maybe we stop eating quite so much, but now we're up till 2 a.m. watching television for no particular reason. Or we start drinking a little bit more than we used to. I have a friend who's doing a psychology doctorate at Cambridge, and she does a lot of study on willpower. And she's found that people have a finite amount of willpower. You know, one of the most interesting experiments is they took two groups of people, and one they said, just sit in this room for an hour, do whatever you want, we don't care. The other said, for the next hour, we just want you to not think about a white elephant. That's all you have to do for the next time. Just don't think about a white elephant. And at the end, they got all the people together and had a little sort of, you know, cocktail party or whatever. And they found that the white elephant people drank twice as much. I'm not kidding. They drank twice as much. Or we found with our kids, what we find with our kids is that they can either be good at school or good at home, but not both. You know, like, you know, they're angels at school and they come home and they're holy terrors, you know, or they're holy terrors at school and they come home and they're angels because they just need a place to be themselves. They need everyone needs a release valve that you can't keep your whole life under control at all times. And so, you know, as hard as we try to change something about ourselves, oftentimes it just doesn't work out the way that we're expecting it to. Okay, so what does this have to do with Jesus? With God. Well, as I said before, our struggles with ourselves and really our addiction to New Year's resolutions, because, you know, even if we, I'm sure at some point you try a New Year's resolution, you know, a lot of people try New Year's resolutions and they're sort of, they do it compulsively somewhat, even though they don't work. These struggles, these addictions, I think, stem from a basic sense of unworthiness that we all carry around, a sense that we are not enough, that we are not good enough, that we don't, not just our actions, but our very being is not enough, that we have a very difficult time. I have a very difficult time accepting myself as I am. I remember being in the subway like a month ago and suddenly thinking to myself, I wonder if there will ever come a time where I'm just happy with myself as I am, and I'm not wishing that I was different. Now, you're all way better people than I am, so you never have that thought. But I certainly do from time to time. And again, this vague sense that if we could just be different, do different, then all of life, you know, if we could find that magic key, then all of life would open up to us. You know, that's why every time I go to FedEx, it's like rack after rack after rack of self-help books. You notice that? Because as people are waiting for their copies to get done or something, they're thinking to themselves, how can I escape myself? And they're like, oh, I will buy this Tony Robbins or this Susie Orman or this whoever book. It doesn't really make a difference. Now, the word for this theologically, in theological language, what we're really talking about here is an issue of justification. Justification. That is to say, we're asking the question constantly of ourselves, what is it that justifies me as a human being, as a person? What is it, or what do I need to do to make me right with myself and my world and ultimately my God? What do I need to do or to be to stand before God and feel that I am right, that I am okay, that I am justified? And of course, what we believe in our core, what we really believe, is that we are justified by being. We are justified by doing. That, again, if we could just do enough or be enough, that we would find that rightness, that okayness, that justification for which we so long. I mean, as Paul says this, talks about this in Galatians and other places, he talks about the elemental spiritual forces of the world, and that's what he's talking about. He's talking about this sense that if I just X, then everything would be okay. Because that really, at the end of the day, that's the essence of what of the law, as Paul talks about it. If I just follow these commandments, if I just love God enough, love my neighbor enough, learn not to covet, I'm not quite so lustful. I'm not quite so coveting of other people's things. If I can do that stuff, then I'll be right with God. I'll be prosperous, and I will be happy. We are looking for our justification in our actions. But of course, it never works because we can never be what we ought to be. And what ends up happening is that this sense of should and ought and the need to justify ourselves, it makes us prisoners. As Paul says in this Galatians passage, it enslaves us. We will never be enough. We will never do enough. Again, remember Benjamin Franklin. You know, he didn't have his Ten Commandments, but he had his 12 virtues. And he would go on a cycle where he would try to perfect one of his virtues all the time. And he found, you know, just when he sort of had mastered charity, then, you know, sloth crept in. That he could never get all 12 right at the same time. That it was just kind of this revolving door, this revolving circle, that it was never enough. But with Jesus, Paul says, something completely new and different has happened. God has done something completely new and different. What has happened is that we are no longer justified, made right, made okay by being or by doing, but by believing, by trusting. This is what Paul means when he talks about justification by faith. That we're not looking to ourselves, to our own performance, to our own humanity or lack thereof, which can never get us there, but we're looking to Jesus. We're looking to his love for us, his sacrifice on our behalf. That because Jesus was God and comes to us and says, I forgive you as you are. I love you as you are. I am with you as you are. We are justified before him. And because we are justified before God, because God says you are okay, maybe we can actually believe it ourselves. Not by looking at ourselves again, because, you know, as long as you're navel-gazing, it ain't gonna be pretty, you know. But if you can look to the God of the universe, who in turn looks to you and says, as Paul says again, you are no longer a slave. You are my child. You are my child, and there is, I hold you in my palm of my hand. There's nothing you can do about it. I have claimed you by adoption. I have come to earth as a baby to find you, to rescue you, to take you home with me. Then maybe we can be okay with ourselves. And not just that, but we can be okay with our place in the world. No matter what happens amidst the waves and the torrents of our crazy, out-of-control lives, to know that we are loved by God suddenly makes things a little bit more bearable. Knowing that even if we never change, even if we can never sort of conquer our sins, our persistent demons, our shortcomings, that Jesus has actually conquered them for us. He has conquered them for us, that we can rest secure in his salvation. Let me just read one paragraph from the end of this article, which I found particularly poignant. So after talking about all the genetic, environmental, and chemical factors that go into, you know, the struggle with weight. And really, you could talk about the struggle with anything. I'm sure they're going to discover an anger gene. You know, they're going to. I mean, they don't need to discover a lust gene. That's just there. What does she say? So where does that leave a person who wants to lose a sizable amount of weight? Weight loss scientists say they believe that once more people understand the genetic and biological challenges of keeping weight off, doctors and patients will approach weight loss more realistically and more compassionately. At the very least, the science may compel people who are already overweight to work harder to make sure they don't put on additional pounds. Some people, upon learning how hard permanent weight loss can be, may give up entirely and return to overeating. Others may decide to accept themselves at their current weight and try to boost their fitness and overall health rather than changing the number on the scale. Now, here's the important part. For me, understanding the science of weight loss has helped make sense of my own struggles to lose weight, as well as my mother's endless cycle of dieting, weight gain, and despair. And let's just, you know, substitute endless cycle of improvement, recidivism, and despair. I wish she were still here so I could persuade her to finally forgive herself for her dieting failures. How amazing would that be? Of course, then she goes on to say, while I do ultimately blame myself for allowing my weight to get out of control, blah, blah, blah. But so here we see she's not willing to let herself off the hook, which ultimately that's what you want, you know, where you want to get. You want to know that you are forgiven because God forgives you. But at least she wants to forgive her mother, to look at her mother, to forgive her mother. And actually, you know what? That's a huge part of the healing process. I remember one of my seminary classes, one of my assignments was to go talk to my parents about their own childhood. And the hope there was that some compassion, some empathy, and some healing for me might result from me realizing that my parents were people. That if you can allow your parents to be people and to forgive them, then maybe you can be a person and forgive yourself. So all that is to say, as we enter 2012 and we think about New Year's resolutions and how we wish we were different and all the things that we struggle with, may I humbly submit that our New Year's resolution be that we live in light of God's forgiveness of us and try a little bit more to forgive ourselves and to forgive the people around us and to find some peace and freedom and hope in the midst of our difficult, messy lives. Let's pray. Lord, there's so many things that we struggle with, so many ways in which we wish we were different, ways in which we harm ourselves and harm other people and are just maybe generally embarrassed and fearful. I pray, Lord, that we would know that even as we look at ourselves and struggle to find things that we like, much less love, that you love us, Lord. That as Paul says, while we were yet sinners, while we were yet angry and overweight and out of control or OCD or whatever we are, Christ, you died for us, the ungodly. I pray, Lord, that we would know that today and this new year, that you would give us peace and freedom and hope in the midst of your love and grace. Pray all these things in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.